Dentistry, like any branch of medicine, is an evolving profession, constantly adapting to new technologies, scientific advancements, and societal needs. During the first century of Ireland's independence, dentists have advocated for better oral health and supported efforts to improve the art and science of dentistry. This story is explored in a recently published book, The Irish Dental Association, A Centenary History. I'm joined by the authors, Dr. Owen Kinsella from the Royal Irish Academy and Dr. Francis Nolan from the School of History at University College Dublin. You're both very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you.
Francis, talk to us a bit about how dentistry was becoming professionalised in the late 19th century in Ireland.
Yeah, well, historically, dentistry was actually carried on as a trade, often through generations of particular families. But the professionalisation of the field occurs from the middle of the 19th century, and it's fuelled really by a Victorian enthusiasm for scientific research and for regulation. So it comes about really through a number of key developments, and these include the award of qualifications in dentistry by universities, the establishment of dental hospitals to provide training and improve professional standards, the introduction of legislation then as well with the 1878 Dental Act, and then the formation of a professional body, which was the British Dental Association in 1880.
And where had we come from, Owen? What had preceded this professionalisation? Some pretty barbaric treatments, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the word that we would come across quite a lot was quackery, to refer to the kinds of practices that went on. And that's not to diminish the legitimate trade that was being practiced, but there was a lot of people who were practicing dentistry who didn't have any qualifications, even after the qualifications began to be introduced. And I think that's kind of a key point of what Francis is talking about there in terms of the professionalisation and kind of the standardisation of the different practices that dentists would go through. And one of the main reasons the BDA was set up, the British Dental Association, which forms an Irish branch later on, of course, is to monitor the profession to make sure that standards are being kept up to the regulations that are put in place. And, you know, one of the ones that we came across in our research was a report on a person masquerading as a dentist in Cork. I think this is 1905 or 1906, and there's a report he's charged with manslaughter because he pulled six teeth from an 18-year-old girl's mouth and she bleeds to death. And that's the kind of thing that I suppose the regularisation and the professionalisation of dentistry was supposed to stamp out. And the IDA would have been to the fore, or sort of the Irish branch of the BDA would have been to the fore in early efforts to stamp that kind of practice out and get rid of people like that from practising dentistry.
So, Francis, you mentioned the British Dental Association. Mm-hmm. That comes about in 1887. When does the Irish Dental Association happen, and at what point does it separate itself from the British Dental Association?
Yeah, so the Irish branch, the BDA itself is established in 1880, and then 7 years later, Irish members of that association established the Irish branch. And really then it's in existence for 25 years up until the point of the formation of the Free State, at which point then the Irish Dental Association is formed. And as Owen mentioned there, much of their energy during that time is given over to combating quackery. And this is done kind of by increasing the number of qualified dentists, improving standards and training and education. So that's very much their focus, I think, for their lifespan.
And I think that the Irish Dental Association or Irish dentists would have tended to have been overwhelmingly Protestant and perhaps unionist. And that causes problems in 1922. I mean, there's almost a split, almost like Brendan Behan, the first thing on the agenda.
Yeah, well, it's interesting with the IDA. I think, you know, the move to establish the association is actually a decisive response to an altered political reality. So it's actually only a number of weeks kind of after the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty that you have the Irish branch moving to establish an Irish Dental Association. They send out a letter to members announcing their intention to do so. And that's because they recognised, regardless of religion, you know, they recognised that a new body would be needed to operate in a new jurisdiction, which was the Irish Free State. So it made practical sense, but it was also kind of a bold move by a professional body, which were socially and politically conservative at this time. And, you know, it's worth, I think, kind of comparing it to the Irish branch of the British Medical Association, which actually stays in existence until the 1930s. So it's quite a bold move, as I've said, to do so.
But there are tensions about whether or not you should propose a toast to the king in 1922.
Yes, absolutely. So it is, I mean, given that it's a very fraught political climate, it's actually a pretty amicable setup process for the Irish Dental Association. You know, there is talk at one point of establishing an all-Ireland body. this doesn't come to fruition, and subsequently then a Northern Irish branch of the British Dental Association is formed. So that would give the impression, I think at least initially, that political concerns are trumped by professional concerns. But that's obviously not the case in Ireland in the early 1920s. And then with that, what you see at the Irish Dental Association annual dinner in 1923 is the decision to include a toast to King George VI results in a quick split in the association. Straight after the dinner, about 50 dentists sign a letter protesting the toast. Subsequently then, six members of the anti-toast faction infiltrate the board of the association.
The anti-toast faction.
Yes, yes. They infiltrate the council, and they attempt then to dissolve the Irish Dental Association and replace it with the Irish Free State Dental Association.
Yeah, and it's probably worth pointing out that the toast was there because it was proposed because members of the British Dental Association were in attendance at the dinner, as yes. was Tim Healy, the Governor General of the Free State. And, you know, it was to, I suppose it was to a court tradition as well. They'd always had their tradition there, and there was no view that this would be a political problem. And they solved it fairly amicably, I think, as well. And it is probably worth saying as well that this secession from the British Dental Association, it's very amicable. There's no issue with it whatsoever. And as Francis said, they're the only medical professional organisation in Ireland to actually take this step of setting up an independent association, independent from its British parent association, if you like. And that's a really interesting development, and it's something that's kind of glossed over a little bit.
And one of their jobs, obviously, is to represent their members, but also the Irish Dental Association is lobbying the government from the 1920s onwards for better policies in relation to dentistry and social healthcare in general.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's for the first two decades maybe of its existence, the IDA's main focus is on improving dental standards, improving dental policies, but also in terms of bringing in the legislation necessary to, I suppose, to regulate the profession. And that's part of the whole process of forming a new state that sometimes is forgotten about, is what kind of legislation is in place. And all dentists who practice in Ireland had to register on what was called the Dental Register. That was run by the British Medical Council. And under legislation from 1921, which obviously was passed by a parliament in Westminster. So there's a question then from 1922 onwards, what legislation governs dentistry in Ireland? And the answer is none. So there's huge problems in terms of actually trying to get a professionalisation and a regularisation of the profession of dentistry from that point onwards. And it's not until 1928 that legislation is actually enacted by the Oireachtas. So there's a 6-year delay there, which leads to this kind of resurgence almost of quackery, again, to use that term, of people beginning to practice, trying to practice, who don't have the qualifications in place. So 1928 is when we have the Dentist Act that sets up an Irish Dental Register, which is first published in 1930. And there's 553 dentists listed on that at that time in 1930. And it's the first piece of legislation brought into place for dentistry. And it's another 60 years before updated legislation was brought in. And you can imagine how outdated the 1928 Act was by 1985 when that piece of legislation was brought in.
Indeed. And things do begin to improve. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, even in the 1940s, things were still pretty grim. One of the presidents of the IDA, a man called J.B. Moorhead, describes some of the things that he encounters in his practice. Owen?
Yeah, it was J.B. Moorhead. He was the president of the Irish Dental Association. And at their annual dinner, he talked about the conditions that faced the public dental officers. So these were people who were working for the public service, because you have two classes of dentists in Ireland. You have those who are working in private practice and those who are working in public practice. So he's the chairman also of the public dental officers group. And he describes an event when he's in a parochial hall, which he says is no more than a converted stable. This is in the mid-1940s. And he's trying to treat children, trying to treat people under the public dental scheme. And he's sterilizing instruments over a fire that's fed by ashes. And he says that by the end of the day, he's using water that's like gruel. It's just thick,
this is a
thick
turf
with ashes.
Fire,
this is a turf fire, exactly, a turf fire. And he says that's the kind of, I suppose, those are the kinds of standards. And those are the facilities that they had in place. And they were nowhere near what was needed. And there was also far too few public dental officers working in the state as well for the population.
Very surprised I was to discover that actually Ireland was one of the first countries to introduce fluoride to water.
Yeah.
Just explain the background to fluoridation, if you would. and how we got involved so quickly.
It spreads from the belief within dentistry, and it's always been a huge part of dental practice in Ireland, is that prevention is much better than remediation. So the idea was that in the late 1940s and in the early 1950s, there was emerging research to show that by putting fluoride in the water, it would decrease the number of dental cavities that you would find in children, and as well as that, obviously, then in future years in adults. And the IDA were really, really strong supporters of that research from a very, very early time. And one of their very heavily involved members, Seamus McNeil, he's appointed as the state's very first dental advisory officer in the Department of Health in 1952. And he gets the chief medical officer support to set up the Fluorine Consultative Council in 1956. That has the dentists on that are all members of the IDA. Their report is issued in 1958 to say it's a very good idea if we put fluoride in the water supply of the entire country. It's a huge step, and no other country in the world had made that decision yet. You'd had, like in Grand Rapids in Michigan, you'd had the fluoridation of a local water supply. You had similar things in the UK as well, but there'd never been a move around the world to put fluoride in the entire nation's water supply. So that leads to...
Conspiracy theories, I'm sure, is
one way to put it, yeah. And there's a couple of groups, but there's a few groups that oppose this idea. There's one called the Pure Water Association, which is actually an offshoot of another group which had pre-existed called the Soil Association. And the Pure Water Association asks the Department of Health, can they be on the Fluorine Consultative Council to give its input? But the feedback that they get from the Department of Agriculture is that the Soil Association and ergo the Pure Water Association are a bunch of cranks, so they don't get to have their say. But there is very, very consistent and very concerted opposition, and it's funded as well from externally. So there's an external funding coming in from the US, and the IDA end up reaching out to their American counterparts, the American Dental Association, and asking for them for tips and support on how to combat this misinformation. So they draw up a pamphlet or a leaflet with help from the American Dental Association to counteract that kind of narrative.
And there's religious opposition as well, something called the League of the Kingship of Christ.
That's right, and Riaguk, yeah, they were one of the other three main, the other main group opposing it. So there was opposition coming from all across the board, but what Sean Lamass did, and what the government at the time did, was they went to the Irish bishops and they asked for their advice, and they said that there was no ethical objections to doing this. So that kind of brought, I think, anybody who might have had a religious objection mostly back on side.
Now, the IDA represents private dentists and publicly employed dentists. Is there not a conflict there? Is there tension, or was there historically tension there?
Yeah, it's something that they've managed remarkably well, given that both sides of those that divide sometimes are very different and very competing priorities. And it's something that really the IDA had to pivot towards, including within its remit from the late 1940s onwards. And it's only from the late 1940s that the state really starts to take a strong interest in providing public dental health services. That accelerates from 1970 onwards, but really it's with the National Health Insurance Scheme in the 1940s. And at the time, the IDA was very strongly opposed to the idea that there would be any kind of state benefit scheme put in place, because they thought that this would take away from the earning power of their members. And at the time, the public dental officers were a very small minority within the IDA's membership number. So that, I think it must have been very, very difficult for them. There's no real overt, the records aren't there to show what kind of tensions there might have been between them and the private practice, but I think it must have been a bit of an issue for them. The solution in some ways was for the IDA to come on board with the idea of a public dental health system by advocating for its private practice members to fill the gap where there weren't enough public dental officers. The private members would see publicly funded patients and be reimbursed by the government. And that's the kind of the beginnings of the system that we have in place now, where you can go to see your dentist and get your dental treatments under your PRSI scheme or whichever one it is.
Francis, at the end of the book, you've got a section called Operatory Lights, which covers some very interesting stories that don't fit into the broader narrative of the book. Let's hear a few of those stories now. One of them, for example, is the story of the first woman to formally qualify as a dentist in Ireland. Tell me about her.
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing to say is professionalisation has the unfortunate effect of excluding women from dentistry. Historically, they had practised dentistry when it was carried on as a trade, often as part of a family business. So with professionalisation, then the door is closed effectively on women for a number of years. So it's not until 1895 that the first woman, she's an English woman named Lillian Lindsay, actually became the first in Britain or Ireland to graduate, to qualify as a professional dentist. And she graduated from the Edinburgh Dental Hospital and School. And Lindsay had actually previously applied the London Dental Hospital, but was unsuccessful after she was forced as well to interview on the steps outside the building because the dean of the school was afraid that she'd distract all the male students inside. So there were considerable barriers to women practicing in the profession. But following Lindsay's example then, Mary DeSales McGuinness, who was born in Lurgan in Armagh and came from a medical family, she became the first woman to qualify as a dentist in Ireland when she graduated with a Bachelor in Dental Science from Trinity in 1908. And that was just 4 years after women were first allowed to enter the university. But McGuinness would kind of later reflect on her experience in Trinity and to some extent echo Lindsay's experience by recalling that women weren't actually permitted to sit with men in lectures. They weren't permitted to speak to men in the college park. And they also obviously had to dress with sufficient modesty. And she's pulled up on the fact that she hasn't dressed with sufficient modesty and advised to preserve a strict college attitude then at one point as well. So it wasn't an easy path for McGuinness or for other women, I think, entering a university at that time. But she obviously continues on and graduates then.
And then how did the public react to her?
Well, she actually works then in kind of a public-facing role with the Women's Health Association.
Yeah.
And she encounters obviously public members of the public at that stage. And she said that most people were absolutely happy to be treated by a woman, but that she encountered a number of men who were sceptical, at least to say the least at first. So not always the easiest to convince.
There's also a section on dentists in the 1916 Rising. You've profiled a few people who got caught up in the rebellion with tragic consequences. Tell us about Charles Hachette Highland.
Yeah, well, Highland is an interesting case. He lives in and around Mount Street. So, you know, when the Battle of Mount Street occurs during the Rising, he's right on the front lines and he actually treats the wounded in that area. But following on from that, then tragically, he looks out his back door one evening and is caught by a stray bullet then in the fighting. So he is one of a handful, I think, of casualties with Irish dentists. So another one then, probably the most prominent, is a man named John O'Duffy, who was really a kind of really important early reformer within the Irish branch of the British Dental Association. And he's also then a co-founder of the Dublin Dental Hospital. But he's a major figure. He lives on the north side of the city near the Rotunda. And he's actually shot then in the crossfire on Sackville Street again. And he actually is the senior member of a prominent family of dentists in Dublin. His son, Kevin, is the president of the Irish branch. He's also a committed imperialist and a home ruler. And he's also surgeon dentist to the Lord Lieutenant, Lord Aberdeen. And the O'Duffys are a really interesting family, I think, because they demonstrate, I suppose, some of the divisions that were evident in Irish society at this time. So Kevin O'Duffy's son, Aymar, he's actually a committed nationalist and socialist. So while his father implores with him to join the British Army on the outbreak of the First World War, he refuses. He becomes obviously a member of the IRB and also the Irish Volunteers. And he has a very important role in the 1916 Rising then, because Aymar O'Duffy, along with Bulmer Hobson, go and warn Owen McNeill about plans for the Rising. And McNeill then obviously issues his countermanding order to cancel the rebellion.
Well, the book is called The Irish Dental Association, A Centenary History. It's published by Eastwood Books. And my guests are the authors Owen Kinsella and Francis Nolan. Thank you both very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Miles. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
After the break, Joseph E. A. Connell joins me to talk about the 1922 Constitution, partition, and how independence affected the lives of ordinary citizens in the Irish Free State. Stay with us.